You know, one of the things we're faced with as believers and as we live for the Lord is resisting the pressure to conform to the world we live in. It's insidious, and it's also very subtle. You don't realize you're being steered in a certain direction. You don't realize that you're being intentionally influenced, that someone is trying to change your thinking and your attitude and your beliefs. But man, it comes at us from all directions. Now, you might think living up here in the sticks that we're kind of removed from all that, but let me tell you, the slide into godlessness might not reach us first, but it reaches. It reaches up Spirit Lake Highway and every place else too. There are so many things that were once shameful and only spoken of in whispers that are now just business as usual. I remember being about 12 and I heard my mom and dad talking about the high school girl two houses down had to get married. I had no idea what they were talking about. And now it's no big deal. You know, now they have nurseries at the schools. And I guess that's not a bad thing, but I'm just saying we kind of slowly, you know that old saying about if you throw a frog in a pot of boiling water, he'll just jump out. But if you throw him in a pot of cold water and then slowly turn the heat up, he'll stay in there till he cooks to death. And we are the frog. And the world is cranking up the heat. And it's just so subtle that we usually don't notice it. The world, the culture and the society of mankind, not just America, everyone, everywhere, I want to say especially America, but maybe that's just because that's what I'm familiar with, is racing down a path that leads away from God. All you got to do is watch the news, read the paper, pick up a Time or a Newsweek or one of those news magazines. Our culture, I don't know, it's like a black hole, you know, that just swallows everything that gets close to it. Or it's like a tornado that's always on the move and destroys everything in its path. It's like we're being sucked down the drain and somebody keeps hitting the flush button. You know? Or pull the handle, or whatever you've got at your house. So in light of that reality, the question becomes, how do God's people keep from getting caught up in that flow? Or to put it another way, how do we live the right way in a wrong world? Well, Psalm 5 answers that question. And as always, it comes down to confidence in God's commitment to protect his people. Now that's easy to say. Confidence in God's commitment to protect his people. Easy to say, easy to understand. It's easy to do. It's just that we so often forget to trust God's truth and have faith enough to follow him. Now, Lord willing, our time in the Word this morning will shore up any shaky faith and teach us to trust God absolutely. So let's read these 12 verses in Psalm chapter 5. To the chief musician with flutes, a psalm of David. Give ear to my words, O Lord. Consider my meditation. Give heed to the voice of my cry, my King and my God, for to you I will pray. My voice you shall hear in the morning, O Lord. In the morning I'll direct it to you and I will look up. For you're not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness, nor shall evil dwell with you. The boastful shall not stand in your sight. You hate all workers of iniquity. You shall destroy those who speak falsehood. The Lord abhors the bloodthirsty and deceitful man. But as for me, I will come into your house in the multitude of your mercy. In fear of you, I'll worship toward your holy temple. Lead me, O Lord, in your righteousness because of my enemies, Make your way straight before my face, for there is no faithfulness in their mouth. Their inward part is destruction. Their throat is an open tomb. They flatter with their tongue. Pronounce them guilty, O God. Let them fall by their own counsels. Cast them out in the multitude of their transgressions, for they have rebelled against you. But let all those rejoice who put their trust in you. Let them ever shout for joy because you defend them. Let those also who love your name be joyful in you. For you, O Lord, will bless the righteous. With favor you will surround him as with a shield. Okay, Psalm 5. We talked a few weeks ago. This is kind of the classroom section for you Bible students, and then we'll get into the more applicational devotional study in a second. We talked a couple of weeks ago about Hebrew poetry. Hebrew poetry doesn't, it's not the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain. Moon, spoon, June. It's not that kind of poetry where the words rhyme at the, or the vowels rhyme at the end of the sentence. It's more a rhyming or a harmony, if you will, of the ideas. The ideas harmonize with one another, and we talked about different kinds of parallelism, you know, antithetical parallelism, which is where one line makes a statement positively, the next line kind of states it negatively. You know, you, Lord, are wonderful, but, you know, not so with the ungodly, kind of, you know, plus, minus kind of thing. This psalm, Psalm 12, is what's called an inclusio. It doesn't really matter if you remember that word or not. Some people find it interesting or helpful because you really can't see it unless you really examine, kind of diagram this thing. Inclusio comes from the word inclusion or include. And what it is this. This particular psalm is like this. There's the main point, the first, you know, a whether it's a sentence or two, there's the main point stated. And then if you're visualizing this like an outline, the next part, the sub point is indented, you know, one line, and then there's that idea, and then there's a sub idea, indent on the third line, sub idea, then the third idea is repeated, and then the sub point is repeated, and then at the end, the main point is repeated. Now, in English, we don't see that, but in Hebrew, or again, if you just study the passage as far as the ideas that are presented, you really do see that inclusio kind of layout, and there are different forms of that. I just thought that some people might find that interesting. Now, the context here, it doesn't tell us, you know, when we studied Psalm 3, it told us David wrote this when he was, you know, faced with that problem with Absalom, and this one doesn't say that, but you can kind of read between the lines, and, you know, somebody is on David's case big time. Kind of they, you know, people in general. I'm sure he has his counselors and his confidants and his supporters, but as he describes these people, you know, they, those who speak falsehood, you know, the bloodthirsty and deceitful man. These are the pressures that are on David's life coming from all around him. But it's also speaking less specifically and more prophetically, it's an amazingly accurate description of the world we live in today and the attitude of the ungodly, both towards the Lord, towards his people, towards the whole idea of right and wrong. You know, this moral relativism is just crazy. You know, it used to be, in the Middle East culture, which, you know, the Middle Eastern culture wasn't, people weren't raised with the Ten Commandments always ringing in the background. Now, most people in our country don't pay attention to the Ten Commandments, but the influence of the commandments from day one, when the first people founded this country, it exists today. Americans just understand it's not okay to lie. And we lie, but we don't argue that it's okay. We know it's okay. You don't steal, you don't cheat, you don't murder. You know, you're not, at least we agree with the principles. In the Middle East, those, what do you call it, you know, foundational assumptions have never been part of their culture or their living. And so in the Middle East, the only bad lie is the one you don't get away with. If I want to go back in that car I've got for sale and roll the odometer back a couple hundred thousand miles, and you buy the car and you think it's got 35,000 miles when in reality it's got 235,000 miles, well, as long as you don't catch me, I'm not doing anything wrong. And if you do catch me, it's like, oh, got me. No big deal. You know, no lawsuits, no arrest for false advertising or whatever, those kinds of things. And so there's this mindset of there is no right and there is no wrong, because where there is no belief in the one true God who establishes these absolute rights and wrongs, then it's kind of anything goes. Whatever you can get away with is okay. If I go to your house and I steal something and you don't realize it, then hey, good for me. You find it missing 6 months later. You know, whatever happened to that? Whatever happened to Grandma's silver? Whatever happened to Grandpa's retirement gold watch? You know, well, hey, you know, I don't know what happened to it. But I profited, you know, got away with it. So David deals with these people, and we deal with this culture where right, you know, what's right for you is right for you. What's wrong for you is wrong for you. And if it's okay with me, then it should be okay with you that it's okay with me. And who are you to tell me anyway and set the standard? Because there is no standard, because what is God anyway but a word in a book? And, it, you know, if you want to believe it, that's cool. I don't believe it. That should be cool with you. Oh, man. It's like my buddy that went to this one church who would call itself a Christian church. It's really on the fringe, if Christian at all. But he went to this church and he kind of sat through the service and he didn't really get it, what was going on. And he went up and he asked the pastor, the speaker, said, well, what do you guys, you know, what do you believe here? What's your doctrine? What's your, you know, liturgy? What do you believe here? And this is a quote. He said, well, we believe it's cool to believe whatever you want to believe unless you don't believe that. And that's not cool. It's funny, isn't it? It's also sadly reality. So, we dig into this psalm here. If you're going to live right in a wrong world, the first thing you got to do is recognize the only one that can help. Give ear to my words, O Lord. Consider my meditation. Give heed to the voice of my cry, my King and my God. The word Lord here, for those of you that are new to the Bible, look closely, and in most Bibles anyway, you'll see that those are all capital letters. Actually, it's capital L, and then what they call small caps, O-R-D. That is sort of Hebrew code for the name that God gave Moses at the burning bush. Now, the Jews considered this name so sacred, they refused to speak it, and they refused to write it down. So they only wrote the consonants down, and the English translation of those consonants comes out to be YHWH. Now, in some places, a Y is pronounced like a J, and a W is pronounced like a V, and so we came up with this word Jehovah, which I guess is as good a guess as anything. I kind of lean more towards Yahweh, just because a Y sounds like a Y to me, and the W sounds like a W, but who am I to say? We were watching a movie last night, and this guy had his name on the back of his jacket, his first name, and it was E-A-G-H-N. I forgot to say this guy was Irish. The gal goes, hey, Eichen. And he turns and gives her a nasty look and says, it's Owen. So, you know, who knows these pronunciations, you know, versus the spelling. It's anybody's guess. But this is who he's talking to. Hear me when I call Yahweh. In Exodus, it's the I am that I am. I am all there is. I am all that you'll ever need. I am all that there ever could be and all that there ever was and all that there ever will be. That's who he's talking to here. He calls him my King and my God at the end of verse 2. You know, King, that's pretty easy. God is the word that the Hebrews used. Usually it's translated Elohim. You may be familiar with that word, my Elohim. Now, the interesting thing about Elohim is that it's a word that is it's not exactly plural, but it's a word of an implied compound unity. You know, Elohim is not singular. It also doesn't mean two. We have words like duo or pair, which mean, you know, exactly two. I don't know why they call this a pair of pants. What? I have one pair of pants. How does that work? Is this half a pant? I don't know. But, you know, Elohim is a word that implies a oneness, a unity of at least three or more, which is kind of a the way that God sneaks these things in there, kind of a little Easter egg, a little surprise that kind of points to the Trinity, even here as he just uses the word God in English. But this is who we got to talk to if we're going to learn to live the right way in a wrong world. Now, the second part of verse 2, give heed to the voice of my cry, or the first part of verse 2, give heed to the voice of my cry. Verse 3, my voice you shall hear in the morning I will direct it to you. Obviously, he's talking about prayer here. There's a song by a country western singer. It's like 10, 12 years, 15 years old now. And there's a line, it's a girl singer, I think it's Trisha Yearwood, if it matters. And she's singing along about some kind of troubles she's having, probably something romantic, you know, love life stuff. And she's complaining about this problem and that. And there's a line in the verse where it says, and I asked my preacher, and he just said to pray. And the implication is, what good's that going to do? You know, that doesn't help me. I asked him what to do, and he said, well, just pray. Well, wait a minute. This isn't a word, this isn't an idea that means when something goes wrong, you throw up a quick, you know, plea for help. It's the idea that Paul talks about in the New Testament when he says, pray without ceasing. See, we have this privilege as New Covenant believers, with the Spirit indwells us, and we have this privilege of constant, ongoing connectedness to God. It's there for us if we take advantage of it. It's like a phone and the number's been dialed and he answered and now we hold the phone in our hand and the question is, will we talk in it? Will we listen to it? Or will we just hold it down here and say, boy, I sure wish God would tell me what to do. That's the idea here. This you gotta, you know, understand who you're talking about and who you're talking to here. There's this active, ongoing conversation. I think this is something, and we studied it in the New Testament as well, but this kind of reminds me of that concept where we can practice an unbroken communication with the Lord. You don't have to stop what you're doing or close your eyes or bow your head or fold your hands or do anything, a certain posture. You know, I prefer to look up, but that's just me, and I like to have my eyes open. The Jews always prayed with their eyes open and their heads up, and that's not why I do it. It just feels good to me, you know, to each his own. But the idea that we don't have to stop and say, okay, now I'm praying. Oh, now I'm not. You can pray anytime, anywhere, all day, every day, and that's what Paul meant when he says pray without ceasing. You know, you just have this ongoing conversation with the Lord. Now, I got a friend who does this. He's been practicing this for years. And, you know, at first, it's a little weird to be around him. Because, you know, you're riding in the car with him on the way to lunch, and you get a parking place up front, and he goes, oh, thank you, Lord. But he's not just, it's not just some kind of phony, praise the Lord, thank you, Jesus. He's talking to God. He's been talking to God all the way to lunch. Oh, Lord, we're so looking forward to this lunch. How you doing? How's life? How's your wife? Got a job? Oh, Lord, you know, help. Somebody comes to mind. This guy's got a struggle. And he just, this prayer never stops. That's the idea here. You know, he talks about in the morning. And, you know, I used to argue against the idea that, you know, you have to pray in the morning. Well, I still argue against the have to part. But just let me tell you from, I don't know how many, 20-some-odd years, and I'm sure we can get some amens from people that have walked with the Lord twice or three times as long as I have, that in the morning really is a good time. It's a good time because your head is usually clear and you're, you know, after you wake up, you're awake. Does that make sense? You know, you get a chance to kind of, you know, get the cobwebs out and have your ninth or tenth cup of coffee, whatever it takes for you to get going. And you haven't been distracted by what you got to do at work. You got to take care of the kids. You got to do this at the house. And you just kind of get to establish your day by spending some time talking to the Lord. And then when he says here, hear my voice in the morning I will direct it to you, and I will look up, for you are not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness, nor shall evil dwell with you. The idea here is when it says, I will direct it to you, and some translations use this word, I will wait. You know, you've heard, you know, they who wait upon the Lord. Well, what does that mean, to wait? It means to shut up. If you do all the talking, God may want to tell you what to do. He may want to give you advice. He may want to answer your question. But if all you do is just, I got this problem and that problem, help me with this and help me with that, okay, I got to go see you. And God's going, well, wait a minute. I thought you were asking for my help. He says, well, I am asking for your help. Well, then shut up long enough for me to give it to you. You know, put your head in my word long enough to get something out of what I have to say to you. This idea of waiting on the Lord, you know. It's the, I don't know if I can say it's the only way, but it sure is the best way for prayer to work. In fact, you've heard me say this before. Prayer doesn't start until you're done talking. And we pray at the Thanksgiving, thank you, Lord, you know, over the teeth and over the gums or however that goes, and look out stomach, here it comes, and bless Aunt Sally and, you know, Uncle Jack, and now I lay me down to sleep. And we think that's a prayer. And I guess it is. It's better than nothing. Now I lay me down to sleep. That's what you teach your kids so they learn how to pray. If they're 40, 50 years old and that's still the only prayer they know, guess what? They didn't learn to pray. But it's not for a mature believer. This idea of just, you just open your spirit. Say it any way you want. Open your heart. Open your soul. And whether you look up or look down, eyes open, eyes closed, that doesn't really matter. God's not waiting for you to hit the right posture and then go, okay, now I'll listen to you. He's waiting for you to just open yourself up and then learn to never close yourself off and walk in that constant communion, that constant connection with the Lord. Now, again, recognizing who can help, the only one that can help in verse 4, for you're not a God who takes pleasure in wickedness, nor shall evil dwell with you. See, realize that the only one who can help, the Lord, is one who is completely set apart from evil. Set apart from anything you even remotely could call wicked. Now, here's a neat little grammatical, and this is my translation kind of blows this, because it says, for you are not a God. And in my Bible, New King James Version, that G is translated, but it shouldn't be. Because this is a word, the same word that should have a small g, because it's like the gods of the other nations. You know, Baal is a, quote, god, and all the other ones, Osiris and so forth. And really, if you take a close look at that word, it kind of means, and I'm going to borrow something from Star Wars, it means the force. You know, the mystical, ethereal power out there somewhere. You know, it's what the recovery groups call the higher power before they put a name on it. Because sometimes there's a process involved there, but his name is Jesus. But if you read it this way, you are not the force who takes pleasure in wickedness, nor shall evil dwell with you. He's completely set apart. This word, some of your Bibles, my Bible says wickedness. Some Bibles use the word iniquity. And it means it's a umbrella kind of word where he's referring to just that godless living. It doesn't have to be, you know, murder and you know, the worst thing you can think of. Just going through life kind of, you know, like an ostrich with your head buried in the sand and totally sort of refusing to open your eyes to the reality that God is, you know, that he exists and he's here and he's for you and he's solved your problems by sending his one and only son to die on the cross to fix what's broken inside of mankind. Those kinds of folks. He doesn't dwell with them, nor shall evil dwell with you. They don't dwell with him. Now, so if you're going to live right in a wrong world, that's the first thing you got to do. You got to recognize the only one who can help. I was talking to someone Friday about the idea that You don't want to be found until you realize you're lost. You know? Now, guys never ask for directions. But they definitely aren't asking for directions if they don't realize they're lost. Remember last time I got lost and had to ask for directions? It was so embarrassing. Because I drove around for like 2 hours trying to, I knew this, where this place was, and it wasn't where it was supposed to be. They moved it. And so I had to finally pull into a gas station, and I literally threw my hands up and said, I give up. I'm lost. See, if you don't know you're lost, you won't know you need to be found. And that's kind of the idea with these people here. The world is so lost, it doesn't realize it's lost. And as long as it doesn't realize it's lost, it has no desire or no interest whatsoever in being found. Now, I don't know. I know most everybody here. I see a few familiar or unfamiliar faces. There may be someone here this morning who you just don't realize, or you don't, I could use a little religion in my life. And I got some stuff going on where I would appreciate God's help. But you haven't come to grips with the idea that I am totally and utterly lost. I don't have a clue how to reconnect with my Creator and how I'm supposed to live. But see, until you come to that realization, you can't be found. You can't be found if you don't know you're lost. If you're going to live right in a wrong world, the first thing you got to do is recognize the only one who can help. Then you got to identify what's wrong. And this is where that inclusio business comes up, because this isn't a linear passage. Idea A, idea B, idea C. You kind of this idea, and then another idea, and then yet another idea. Oh, and then back to the other idea, and then we wrap it up nicely by going back to the original idea at the end. And so what happens here as we try to, as I try to organize this in a more Western linear fashion, is that we're going to deal with verses 5 and 6 and 9. But 7 and 8 are another part of that pattern. So verse 5, the boastful shall not stand in your sight. You hate all workers of iniquity. You shall destroy those who speak falsehood. The Lord abhors the bloodthirsty and deceitful man. And then down in verse 9, for there is no faithfulness in their mouth. Their inward part is destruction. Their throat is an open tomb. They flatter with their tongue. See, you got to identify what's wrong. And David here is telling us what to look for to make that identification. First part of verse 5. The boastful, he talks about, shall not stand in your sight. And the idea is not that they shall not be visible, but they shall not stand. They shall not hold up. You know, they shall not stand up or stay standing up in your sight. But the boastful, and some of your translations may say the arrogant. And that really is the idea, that self-pride of boastful and arrogant. I don't need no God to help me out with anything. I'm taking care of business. Which, if you think back on our study through the Beatitudes, which was just a few weeks ago, this is the exact opposite of where Jesus said, blessed are the humble. The humble, those who have an honest assessment of who they are, in light of an honest assessment of who God is the exact opposite of these prideful, boastful, arrogant people. See, that's part of the problem. Watch out for that arrogance, that self-sufficient arrogance that we don't need no stinking God to help us out. And in the second part of the verse, you hate all workers of iniquity. And this is a word that can be, in Hebrew, these words are big, and it depends on the context, but this is a word that is often translated immoral. And you might even stretch that out to be amoral. Immoral means not moral. Moral, or the mores, you've heard that word, the mores of society means kind of the standards. Now, the mores shift, that's the problem. That's what we're talking about here, the right living in a wrong world. The mores keep moving, as it's a moving target, this moral relativism. The immoral means not moral. Amoral means this ain't no morals at all. There's no rule. There's no right. There's no wrong. There's no nothing. They just, everybody do your own thing. And if I can steal from you and get away with it, then good for me. And who cares about you? And I can go to, while you're at church, I can go to your house and break into your house and steal your stuff because I know you go to church every Sunday. And, you know, I got from like 10 to 11:30 to ransack your place. And you know what? But what do you mean that's wrong? What century are you from? The workers of iniquity, which is just the exact opposite when Jesus said, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Not self-righteousness, goody-two-shoes, I toe the line, Casper Milktoast, you know, Ned Flanders. Not that kind of nonsense, but hunger and thirst for just the right things of God. Some things are right. You know, family is right. Grandkids are right. Turkey is right on Thanksgiving. Some things are just right. And he's talking about these people, this you know, the problem is, you know, this workers of iniquity where they don't care about what's right. They don't even recognize that there is such a thing as right or wrong. It's just whatever you can get away with, then good for you. Verse 6, you shall destroy those who speak falsehood. Now, we recognize that as probably a reference to people who lie, but it's a lot more than just a little white lie or even a big bold lie. It's those people who are just dishonest at heart. You know, they've given up the value of honesty, integrity, being a person of character, and they just say what they need to say to get what they want to get, and they have no second thoughts about it. There's no guilt. There's no, it's, you know, that's the definition of a sociopath. I don't know if you realize that, but you've heard it on, you know, Law and Order or something, you know, that identifies some guy as a sociopath. And what that means is he doesn't have the ability to reason about what's right and what's wrong. He just does what he does without any thought. It's not that I don't care. He can't not care because he doesn't even know. The dishonest at heart, which is obviously the opposite of truthful. You know, now that's not in the Beatitudes, but truthfulness is a value, is a characteristic that is part of God's nature that he would have be a characteristic of his people. And it's built into us in a sense, it's ingrained in Americans, like I said, because of our Judeo-Christian ethic, even those who reject it have been influenced by it. But the value of truthfulness, you shall destroy those who have turned their back on the value of truth. And then the Lord abhors the bloodthirsty and deceitful man. This is, you know, you can think of it as those who are just treacherous and threatening. In David's time, it wasn't unusual for someone to just turn up dead. You had bad blood, you had a hassle with somebody, your peacocks were going off in the middle of the night, your dogs were barking, you know, their dog ate your chickens, you know, whatever it was, it could be a big thing, could be a little thing, and oh look, we found old Shlomo in the ditch, and he's all bloody and somebody killed him. I mean, it was a lot more common, it wasn't okay, but it wasn't that unusual either. These days, you know, when someone is killed in our culture, I mean, it makes the news. It's still a big deal. It happens way too often, but it's still a big deal. But that's the kind of thing he's talking about. These bloodthirsty and deceitful people, they are treacherous, they are threatening. Man, that just describes, maybe not our neighborhood, I hope not our neighborhood, but that describes a world we live in. I read a story once by a fellow who is in the 70s, I think, was invited to a meal at the presidential palace in, is it Uganda? Where Idi Amin was the man in power at that time. And just like in a movie, somebody came in and said something to the president and he didn't like it and he pulled out his pistol and he shot him. You know, get that guy out of here. He's just so much trash. He told me that we were out of Kool-Aid or something, you know. Just sort of casual, you know, unthinking, heartless, this treacherous, you know, threatening kind of thing. Now, obviously, the opposite of that is safety and people who are trustworthy. So you got to identify the problem. Verse 9 kind of gives a general description. We won't break it down point by point, but you can see there is no faithfulness in their mouth. Now, again, this is an inclusio inside of an inclusio because he starts with references to speaking. There's no faithfulness in their mouth. Their inward part, just read that as their soul, their heart, the core of their being, is destruction. You know, not creation, not sustenance, not building, not anything good, but just destruction. Their throat is an open tomb. There's a word picture for you. Everything that guy says just reeks of death. Well, turn on, doesn't matter which channel. You know, pick up a paper, open a magazine. It may not be as overt. You may not find what you're looking for unless you learn to look a little deeper than what's on the surface. But that's what's going on. We live in a bloodthirsty and deceitful culture globally. Now, what we're talking about here is the idea of conviction and confession. See, if you don't identify these problems as problems, if you just kind of shrug them off, well, I'm not like that. My family, my next door neighbor, they're not like that. I don't have to worry about that. I don't have to think about that. That's not a problem for me. You got to look again, because this wrong living will sneak up, and you know you're in water that is the heat's being turned up, and if you don't notice it, next thing you know, you're cooked. Confession and conviction. You got to acknowledge what's wrong, you know, with the culture that is influencing you. Whether that's the government or the national, I mean, not government specifically, but the culture on a national scale, or the culture in a household scale, or the culture in a private scale. Just what you're being influenced by. If you don't admit that bad is bad and recognize that good is good, and make some kind of decision based on that, then it's not going to help. You got to learn to refuse to go with the flow of culture. And you got to develop an appetite for what's right that ruins the appeal of what the world says is right or doesn't matter. You know, examples of this are, they abound. And I have a tendency to come back to the same ones, and I don't, you know, that's probably not a good thing. But it's just, you know, what hits me is what hits me. And I'm thinking back, I was in junior high in 1972 when the government gave us permission to murder our babies, the unborn. Now, guess what? About a year after that, I was in a situation where that might have solved my problem. We made another choice, but that was certainly an option available to us. I remember when the worst trouble you could get into at school was like running in the hall, you know, chewing gum in class. Now they got to check and make sure you're not carrying a pistol, you know, or have meth in your pocket or some other crazy thing. I mean, you know, I remember when we talked about this not too long ago, that TV show in the 70s. Again, I'm a child of the 70s. Three's Company, right? Jack Tripper moves in with the two girls and he has to pretend he's gay. Which, that was a scandal, but he had to pretend he was gay because the guy couldn't live with two girls. That would be wrong. But then we watch that show every week, and Jack's so funny, and he's a nice guy, and Chrissy, and whatever her name is, you know, the dark-haired one. And that's on for like 9 years, and next thing you know, we don't give it a second thought. You know, if somebody, you know, had a child out of wedlock, or and again, I don't mean to just focus on the sexual side of things, it's just, I don't know, it's what comes to mind. In this, what would they call it? The sexual revolution, right? In the late 60s, early 70s. Hey, free love. If it feels good, do it. Go for it. You know, men, women, whatever. What's that? You know, dogs, cats, living together. In that, it's a line from Beetlejuice. Never mind. Cut that out of the tape. But, you know, there's just all kinds of stuff that used to be scandalous to us. And then just slowly, over time, it became No big deal. And now you talk to a 13, 14, or 20-year-old or plus who's depressed and feels worthless. And then you get to the bottom of all that and you find out that it's because, you know, I could have been aborted because I wasn't worth keeping. Because that's what we've taught them. And we've been boiled by this frog, you know, I don't know why this keeps coming up, but that thing about the pedosexuals, you know, homosexuality is for the most part accepted in our culture. I don't even want to talk about it any more than I want to talk about heterosexual adultery being accepted in our culture, because they're on the same playing field. One's not way worse than the other. It's adultery is adultery. Sexual sin is sexual sin. And now it's pedosexuality. It's the third week in a row this has come up. But don't be surprised, folks, when instead of a gay couple on TV, it's a guy and a little boy who sleep together. Because, hey, who are you to tell me what's right and what's wrong? And that's just the way it is. And, you know, guys are writing books on how to pull this off and not get into trouble and how not to traumatize the little kid. Because, you know, you don't want to hurt him. You don't want to hurt him. Get your hands off of him. Oh, man. But see, that's what's happening, folks. And I hate to be the guy that cries wolf or makes a big deal out of it. But if you just look back since the 60s at all the stuff that we just... that was wrong, and everybody knew it was wrong, whether they were overtly influenced by God's truth or kind of, you know, through implication influenced by God's truth. And now the whole world's telling us it's okay, it's right, it's no big deal. Well, you're the one with the problem. You Christians are so narrow-minded. God loves everybody. Well, yes, he does. Yes, he does. Thank God. Thank you, God, that you're God, and you love everyone. He loves the drug addicts, and he loves the drug dealers, and he loves the alcoholics, and he loves the adulterers, regardless of gender. You know, and I had somebody, I'm on a tangent here, I gotta shut up. Somebody brought up to me the word orientation, and again, I don't mean for this to be a sexual tirade, but I'll say it again, heterosexual men are oriented to have sex with as many women as they can. You know, what's that old joke? You know you can't have sex with every woman you see, but you try. You know? And monogamy, which is God's standard, one man, one woman, one lifetime, except for maybe cases of death and widowhood and all that. But monogamy goes against the grain of our normal, of our godly orientation. For men, anyway. I don't know about the gals. Yeah, I know about the gals. You know, it goes against the grain, but so what? We say no. We don't say, well, I was just made that way. I had to sleep with the secretary. God made me that way. I had to have sex with the little kid. God made me that way. That's where we're headed. That is where we're headed. And if you don't recognize that, you need to take off the blinders. Because we got to live right in a wrong world. And the way we do that is the third part of this. If you're going to live right in a wrong world, you got to approach God with the right attitude. We've already talked about prayer. And this psalm doesn't address the concept of salvation and surrender to the Lord and the establishing of a relationship with Him. This psalm assumes the relationship exists. So with that as a given, you got to learn to approach God with the right attitude. Verse 7, but as for me, says the believer, I will come into your house in the multitude of your mercy. You got to approach God mindful of his mercy. Now, the New American Standard uses the word loving kindness. The New English Translation uses the word faithfulness. Again, it's one of those big words that means all of those umbrella words that means all those things. You got to be mindful of God's mercy. Why? Because that's the basis of your relationship. If God wasn't merciful, we wouldn't have to worry about any of this. We'd all just be going down that drain, not even aware of it or not worried about it and not trying to figure out how to keep ourselves safe. There's that equation, that three-part equation, justice, mercy, and grace. We've talked about it before. We'll talk about it again. God is perfect in his sense of justice. And we have a skewed sense of justice, but we understand the concept. What's fair is fair, and what's unfair is unfair. Well, God's sense of justice and fairness, if you want to call it that, is perfect. It's immutable. It can't be compromised. Justice, see, is when everybody gets what they deserve. If you, you know, if my kids cross the line, they deserve a spanking. If my kids are especially good, they deserve a treat. And it's kind of the same way we all tend to see life through that lens, through that paradigm. People get what they deserve. That's justice. God's mercy is when you don't get what you deserve in terms of punishment. You know, your kids might earn a spanking, man, they have got it coming, they need to learn a lesson. I mean, there's a punitive part of that, there's a disciplinarian part of that, you know, because part of it is you don't want them to do it again, get into your stuff, you know, mess up your stuff, break your stuff. So you're teaching them, and part of that is just, you know, you did this and you're going to get it. And mercy says, you know what, you deserve it, but we're going to let it slide this time. And then the third part of that equation is grace. See, mercy is when you don't get what you deserve. Grace is when you do get what you don't deserve, which is God's favor, God's love, God's acceptance, God's heart that is just crazy about you, just the way you are, warts and scars and everything. He just loves you. Now, you put those three together. In his perfect justice, sin must be dealt with. You know, there's a crime has been committed. There must be an arrest and a conviction and some, you know, punishment. But then God's mercy says, well, you know, we'll just let them off the hook. And then God's grace says, you know what? As a matter of fact, not only are they off the hook, but now we're going to bless them. We're going to take care of them. And what makes all of that work, and this is where it comes down to the meat of the thing, is the cross. It's what the cross is all about. It's not a necklace. It's not a thing that's on the wall. The cross is where God's perfect justice was satisfied. Jesus took the punishment, the penalty, the consequences for not only the wrong things we say and do, but for what's wrong in us with our being. He took care of that. He satisfied that, which opens the door for God's mercy and God's grace. And so when he says you need to approach God being mindful of his mercy. I like the way the message says this, the first part of this verse. He says, and here I am, Lord, your invited guest. This is incredible. That's the way you got to approach God. The second part of verse 7. In fear of you, I will worship towards your holy temple. Now, we've talked about this so many times, I'm not going to go into it. Fear is not shaking in your boots afraid. Fear is not the blue lights are in the mirror and you've got a glove box full of stuff you're not supposed to have. I understand that fear. That's not what he's talking about. Let me paraphrase this. And this is just, it is just that, a paraphrase. It's not a translation or an interpretation, but a paraphrase. Being fully aware of God's integrity. Being fully aware, like in the, where the message has that, it's incredible. Being blown away by God's integrity, his perfect righteousness that can't be swayed or skewed by circumstances or any external force. He just is what he is, and he's all good, and he's all right. And when he says, I worship toward your holy temple, that it literally means I fall down in the direction of your dwelling place. We should have done that song. We fall down, we lay our crowns at the feet of Jesus. Lord, I'm so overcome by the light and the love and the purity of your goodness that all I can do is get on my face. There's nothing, there's no words. This doesn't cut it. Kneeling doesn't cut it. Lord, I got to get down on the ground as far flattened out as I can get, because that's just the response that the reality of your nature elicits from me. The message has this verse, I enter your house, here I am, prostrate in your inner sanctum. Lord, I come before you in your temple and I just get down. You can't get any more submitted and yielded than that posture. Verse 8. Lead me, O Lord, in your righteousness because of my enemies. Lead me, O Lord. See, part of this approaching God with the right attitude means that you got to be faithful to follow him. Lead me, O Lord. And he says, okay, let's go. And then you're standing back there going, well, I didn't want to go that way. I didn't realize we're going to walk so far. Well, then, chances are the Lord's not going to lead you until you're fully committed to follow him. This is what Jesus said in Matthew 16. This is kind of a long chunk, but I'll try to read it, make sense of it quickly. Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Follow. Get that? For whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? Now the second part of that, I think it might be verse 25. The first part is verse 24. Verse 25 explains verse 24 because he talks about denying yourself, taking up your cross. And then he explains that when he says, for whoever desires to save his life, that would be to not deny himself, will lose it. But whoever loses himself, whoever does deny himself for my sake, will find it, will find life. David says, lead me, O Lord. How do I get out of this mess? How do I live right in a wrong world? I pray, lead me, O Lord, and I commit myself to follow him. And what that following him means is I deny the way the world defines me. And I embrace the way God defines me. You deny yourself. I'm the fat guy who's not very good at athletics and the girls don't like him all in school. And even now he kind of ticks people off. They think he's mad when he's really worried. And and the world kind of makes you feel and think who you are. And he says you got to not just avoid it, but you got to deny it. You got to reject it. And then take up your cross. Embrace. Who's God say I am? I don't know what God says I am, but I know that he likes me. He doesn't care what I look like. He forgives me when I mess up. He knows I don't mean to snap when people think I'm snap and I think I'm just talking. And if I recognize that I'm snapping, then I'm also apologizing real quick. But God knows that, and he loves me, and he accepts me just the way I am, not because of anything about me, but in spite of everything about me. God doesn't love me because of the good things about me. That's not any more impressive to him than the bad things, you know? He loves me because Jesus died on the cross for my sin, and he looks at me, and I have been washed white as snow by the blood of the Lamb, and I'm good to go with God. And so we enter into his temple. We say, lead me, Lord, and that's got to mean that I'll follow. You know, lead me in your righteousness is another way of saying in your will. God's will is always righteous. Lord, lead me where you want me to go, and I'll follow. Again, the message wraps this up really nicely. He says, I'm waiting for directions. You know, when he says, lead me, Lord. I'm waiting for directions to get me safely through enemy lines. That's kind of a war word picture. But I'm waiting for you, Lord, to lead me. It's like, get down. Shh, get behind this bush. Okay, now run. Now duck down behind that fence. Lord, I'm waiting for you to lead me through the enemy lines. And if I'm sitting back saying, well, I'm not going over there. That's dangerous. That's uphill. It's wet over there. I didn't wear the right shoes for this, you know? That's not really much of a commitment to follow. So you've got to approach God with the right attitude before you can expect his help, his protection, to live right in a wrong world. Verse 11 and 12. But let all those rejoice. See, it's one of those great buts. There's all this, but the contrast. Let all those rejoice who put their trust in you. Let them ever shout for joy because you defend them. Let those also who love your name be joyful in you. For you, O Lord, will bless the righteous. With favor you will surround him as with a shield. Look in the middle of verse 11. Let them shout for joy because you defend them. And then at the end of verse 12, surrounding him as with a shield. See, the last part of this approaching God with the right attitude has to do with delighting in his defenses. I'm not all right yet. I'm not safe yet. The world is going down the drain and it's doing its best to suck me down with it until next thing you know, I'm just gone with the flow. And yeah, we're going down, but so is everybody else. And that's just kind of the way it is, you know, no big deal. But no, man, in addition to all these other things, I come to delight in the fact that God defends me and in the way that he defends me. Let all those rejoice who put their trust in you. This is where we get the idea of faith and confidence. Not faith that when I die, I'm pretty sure I'm going to go to a place with clouds and harps, naked babies playing harps. That's cartoons, just like the devil is not a guy with red pajamas and a pitchfork. That's cartoons. He's talking here about when I trust the Lord, that means I live every minute, every second of my life as though God's really going to do what he said he's going to do. And as a matter of fact, if something doesn't happen, then I'm shocked. But see, we're the other way around. Well, I asked the Lord to help me and I'd be doggone if he didn't do it. Can you imagine that? Well, it should be the other way around. We go through all day, every day. You know the Lord's going to take care of you. He's going to provide for you. He's going to protect you. And he does, and you thank him for it because, you know, your prayer never stops. And then once in a while, if something really goes wrong, you're going, well, I didn't expect that to happen. Delight in his defenses. Let them shout for joy. Because you defend them. Let those who love your name be joyful in you. What's God's name? Well, YHWH, I am that I am. I'm all that you need. I'm all there ever will be and all there's ever going to be. And you can pretty much stop looking because I am. You can look, stop looking, or you can start looking here, says the Lord, instead of everywhere else. For whatever kind of satisfaction, fulfillment, contentment, and all the rest that you're after. For you, O Lord, will bless the righteous. Not the self-righteous. Not those who follow the rules. But those who are righteous by grace through faith in who Jesus is and what he accomplished on the cross. Lord, I'm a wretch. You know, amazing grace that saved a wretch like me. I'm still a wretch, but you know what? I'm a delivered wretch. I'm a forgiven wretch. I'm a saved wretch. And the more I trust in that truth, then after a while I stop living like a wretch and I begin to live like a child of the King. And it's not because somebody kept pointing out all my problems. You need to work on this. You can't watch that. You can't listen to that. You can't read this. No, I'm just connected with God and he starts to heal me and he starts to grow me up and mature me. You, O Lord, will bless the righteous with favor. You will surround him as with a shield. There's a picture. God's favor. In the New Testament, favor is usually the word charis, which is grace. Now, I didn't check this out in Hebrew, but the idea of favor is still the same. You know, just the idea that God is for you. He's on your side. He's not looking for a way to wipe you out or cut you off. He's looking for a way. You know, he already found a way to include you and build you up. And his favor will surround you like a shield. Scotty, full shields, boom, you know. And the Klingons can blast at us all day long and it maybe shakes the boat a little bit, but we're not hurt. We're safe. We live in a really wrong world. And again, I hate to be the guy that cries wolf, but see, the reason that you kind of, I know that so often we go, well, it's not really that bad. Well, that's because of we've been boiled, my fellow frogs. And if we could kind of jump back to the way things are supposed to be and then somehow be made aware of the stark contrast between that and the way they are, we would be knocked off of our feet in shock with how far things have gone in the wrong direction. The tub is swirling and help, you know, we're going down and somebody keeps reaching up and pulling that handle. But you don't have to. You can be safe. This psalm tells us how. And it all boils down to confidence in God's commitment to protect you.